David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. David, I know one of the stories is about planet eaters. Let's start with that one.
Hey, Rob. Well, that's a good story to start with. This story has to do with suns, and when I say suns, I mean stars, that eat their own planets.
Is this really so unusual? I understand that our own star, the sun, is going to be eating Earth at some point in the future.
Right. In billions of years, Earth will be swallowed by the sun. So it's not that unusual, but the point of this study is really to address a couple of mysteries that astronomers have seen when they're scanning the universe for all of these, what they call extrasolar planets, planets outside of our solar system. And Rob, for the past two decades, planet hunters have found almost 350 worlds outside of our solar system. But two questions keep on cropping up. The first is when astronomers find these planets, and they usually find the suns that the planets are associated first, they find that older suns tend not to have a lot of planets, or tend not to have any planets very close to them. And the second mystery is that conversely, younger suns tend to have a lot more planets very close to them. And so, as you said, Rob, what could explain that is that these suns are somehow swallowing their planets. But, you know, the question is, what's causing that? And, you know, how exactly is it happening? How common is it?
Because at least as I understand our own case with our own sun, it's when our sun would become a red giant really close to the end of its life cycle that it would become big enough to swallow the Earth.
Exactly.
But something else is going on here.
Something else seems to be going on here. And when researchers ran simulations, it turns out the answer seems to be gravity, which again isn't terribly surprising. But what they find is that, you know, when you've got this really big body next to the small body, the big body, in this case the sun, is exerting a lot of gravitational pull on a nearby planet. And over time, it's pulling that planet closer and closer. It's disturbing the orbit of that planet until eventually the planet gets pulled right into the sun.
So the natural degradation of the orbit of the planet, or perhaps an unstable orbit in the first place.
Exactly. And the effect is actually called the tidal effect. So in fact, they ran this simulation on a real life extrasolar planet called Corot 7, which orbits its parent star at a distance of only a few million kilometers. So that's relatively pretty close. And they found that in a billion years, which is a long time, but still in a billion years, that's what's going to happen to this planet. Its parent star is gradually over time going to pull closer and closer to itself until it eventually consumes it.
Well, given these timescales, I imagine it'd be pretty hard to actually observe this happening. What would be needed to actually prove this hypothesis of where these planets are going?
Well, there's a couple ways. The first thing is that researchers could look at suns and see if they have any sort of unusual rotational wobbles.
Sort of like solar indigestion?
Exactly. And, you know, this is because of the disturbance caused by, you know, these two massive bodies essentially crashing into each other. The other way is looking for chemical signatures in the sun. Are there chemicals that researchers are finding associated with the sun that a sun shouldn't be able to produce by itself, you know, as evidence that, you know, there's parts of a planet there now?
Heavier elements, things like that.
Exactly.
Okay, so what other stories have we brought with you today?
Well, Rob, speaking of things eating each other, have you ever wondered what part of your brain tells you to eat that piece of celery versus that piece of chocolate when you're really hungry?
No part of my brain tells me to eat celery over chocolate, Dave. Come on.
Well, for those of us where it is a tougher choice, you know, the question is there something in our brain that exerts self-control that tells us if you're on a diet, don't eat that piece of chocolate, eat the celery instead? And you know, this is something that neuroscientists have been looking into it for a while, not necessarily because they care about dieting, but because they care about how the brain makes decisions. How do we, you know, look at two options and decide which one to go for?
So this was a brain imaging study?
It was a brain imaging study, and they actually did it with dieters. They took 37 dieters, and they put them in what's called an fMRI machine. And this is a machine that looks at activity in your brain. And if one part of the brain is more active than another, it lights up for all intents and purposes on fMRI. And while these people were in the machine, they showed them pictures of 50 different kinds of foods, you know, all different kinds from unhealthy to healthy, from delicious to not very delicious. And they asked the dieters, rank these foods on a scale of 1 to 5 in terms of how healthy or how tasty you would judge these foods to be.
So two different scales there.
Exactly. And then they asked the participants to choose. They said, okay, we'll take this food that was sort of neutral on your scales in terms of taste and health, and let's compare that to the other 49 foods you saw, and you tell us whether you'd rather have your neutral food or one of these other foods.
So for example,
say you chose a cracker as your neutral food, and then I showed you all the other 49 foods, and one by one we went through and I made you choose, would you rather have a cracker, say, than a candy bar? Would you rather have a cracker than an apple? What they found was that about half the people were always going for these less healthy and tastier treats than they were going for the healthier treats, even though they claimed to be dieters.
And what part of the brain then lit up?
Well, that was the really interesting part. What they found was that when the people were making the healthy decisions, when they were choosing the apple or the piece of celery, a part of their brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex lit up. And this region has been previously associated with learning and memory. But it seemed to be that the people that were really making these healthier decisions, or the decisions that you and I would maybe associate with self-control, this brain region was really active when people were doing that. When people were choosing the unhealthy decisions, this brain region wasn't really active. So you can sort of think about this brain region maybe like the concerned mother in your head that says, you know, hey, I know you're making a decision right now and you should really go for the healthy food.
So now we know where it's happening in the brain. What do we do with that information?
There's a bunch of potential applications. You can think anything that deals with self-control, whether it be dieting or drug use, might be related to this region in the brain. So say if scientists could find, say, a drug that increased activity in this part of the brain, then maybe you could give a bit more self-control to people that don't have it naturally.
Okay, and I see you have one more story with you today. What's that one about?
Well, Rob, this last story is about smart materials.
How are they smart, Dave?
Well, Rob, imagine an airplane wing that turned red right before it was about to break, or supports on a bridge that turned different colors right before the bridge was about to collapse. That would be useful, right?
Sounds pretty smart.
And this research has to do with this realm of smart materials, which is, can we engineer plastics and other types of materials to do more than just, you know, be plastic, you know, to be a support or to be structural or whatever? Can we make plastics that repair themselves? And in this case, can we make plastics that tell us when there's something wrong with them? And for this study, the real trick was researchers trying to figure out, what can we put into plastics? What can we put into the polymers that make up plastics while the plastics are being made that will give them this ability to, say, change color when they start to get really stressed, you know, a sign of that they might break?
So it's not as if they would put a dye or something. I mean,
right. They're actually putting molecules into the polymer. As the polymer is made, they're inserting these ring-shaped molecules, which they call mechanophores. And right there in the name, mechano, you're saying that, you know, that there's something that senses mechanical stress. And what they found is if they put these mechanophores in polymers as the polymers were being made, and then they made plastics out of the polymers, as they bent these plastics, the plastics would start to turn red because these mechanophores are breaking. And when their structure breaks, it changes the structure of the entire polymer. That changes its light reflective properties. And hence, you've got a color change when the plastic is under too much stress. And you can actually see a time-lapse picture of this on the site.
Well, I can imagine plenty of applications. You mentioned a couple at the outset. Are there any concerns about using these types of materials with these kinds of built-in sensing abilities, if you will?
Well, one potential problem right now is that these materials can reverse back to their original colors if, say, a certain type of light shines on them. So that's a big problem because, you know, if you've got a bridge and the supports on the bridge are turning red, and you don't catch it while it's red and, you know, it reverts back to its original color again, then something's wrong and you don't know about it. You're back in square one. So this is a technology that's still at its early stages, but it, as you said, it's showing a lot of promise and there's a lot of potential applications once they really get it refined.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about DNA origami, folding DNA into various shapes for various purposes, and also a disappearing act for the world's second largest fish. Scientists have finally figured out where this shark is going when it's disappearing. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we're continuing our regular coverage of swine flu. We've got updates. We've had a lot of exclusive interviews with some of the big people involved with the flu. But we've got a lot of non-flu news as well. You know, with President Obama's stimulus package, there's been a flood of applications to the NIH because the NIH has made some money available for extra scientific grants, what they're calling challenge grants. And so far, the NIH has been flooded with 15,000 applications, and that number seems to be rising. And also a story about the Pentagon's hackers. It turns out that the cyber attack capabilities of the United States are probably more powerful than the most sophisticated cyber attacks perpetrated by cyber criminals. So that's a really interesting item as well. You can find all these items on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.